Can I get the icon in cornflower? Blue flower.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to episode 21 of Can I Get That Software in Blue? I'm one of your hosts, Chad Tindall, and along with me is my co-host who stopped writing code to take his new UTV off-road. He invests his capital in ways that are magical because that's just how he enjoys his sabbatical. The open source radical, Steve Mazak, everybody.
Oh, my goodness. Chad, that was great. Thank you for welcoming me and spending time on the intro. I appreciate it. It's good to see you.
Well, you keep sending me pictures of this UTV that you took out, and I hope you're not flipping it anymore. I know there
No, I think flipping it was a one-time thing, hopefully, knock on wood.
It should be a one-time thing if you do it right.
That's what happens when your ego is bigger than your capability, I guess.
You did an RTFM before you took it out? Was that the problem?
I did. I just ignored it. It said, don't do donuts. And so I'm like, well, I'll try a donut. It worked yesterday. It could work today.
And then you woke up upside down.
Yeah. I'm just grateful no one was hurt.
Yeah, definitely.
But I'm learning slowly, like every time I take it out now, like just try a little bit more, right?
And trying to push it to the edge.
Well, see, I'm trying to find my limits, like, because it's not about pushing that thing to the edge. It's about overcoming the PTSD I have from rolling it. Like, quite honestly, every time I step on the gas and the back end gets loose, it freaks me out. So, but that's how you're supposed to drive that thing. So I'm learning.
I never try to push anything to the limit, like snowboarding. I'm just sticking to blue runs, wakeboarding. I'm not doing any crazy jumps. Like, I'm just happy to ride on the water. You know, that's it is.
I hear you. I get a little overexcited about stuff. So
yeah. I've seen a lot of people get injured, so I try to avoid the easy the easy mistakes. Well, it seems like after the Gaurav episode about venture capital, our listenership doubled, and at least it's continuing through the episode with Emil. I've had a bunch of people reach out, tell me how much they liked that episode about collective intelligence, and listening to it again when I was editing it, I was really proud of that episode. I thought it came out really good.
Yeah, there's a lot of good stuff in there. That collective intelligence stuff I haven't stopped thinking about, so.
Totally.
I want to see how I can incorporate it into things going forward.
I'm excited to see what you do with it in your next role and how you actually build that into how you operationalize things.
Yeah, it could be interesting.
Well, our guest today runs commercial operations for a hot new startup called Memento, a leader of sales who knows all the details, a consummate professional that's rarely digressional. He's highly numeric, but never esoteric. Eric Hakela, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Chad and Steve. Well, like the rhymes.
We like to bust it out every now and then.
I think Chad's just practicing for his rap career eventually.
It is. Well, C-Note is my rap name. You know, that's what that's what they call me down in the clubs. Nice. Well, Eric, you used to run the worldwide go-to-market motion for all databases at AWS, but you left earlier this year to join this new startup called Memento. Well, why don't we start there and tell us about Memento and what they're doing?
Yeah, so at Memento, you know, essentially what we're bringing to market are data tools for the data stack that are missing in a serverless toolkit. Our first service to market is a serverless cache. And so when I say cache, we're actually talking about a backend cache, right? That's actually one of the challenges in this space is that caching is ubiquitous and kind of everywhere. But in some ways, it's actually lost its meaning because it is everywhere, right? When someone says cache, it could mean everything from the, you know, the cache on your web browser on your local laptop. It could be a cache on the edge in the CDN. In this instance, what we're talking about is a backend cache that's caching a database or another data store deep in cloud infrastructure of large infrastructure operators.
That's so that it's in memory so that people don't need to go to the database if they've done that recently.
Correct. And so the two primary ways to use it are a cache on the database or sometimes even as a semi-persistent in-memory data store. And so really the key to what we've seen is that, you know, there was a really big gap in this market. Again, you know, tools like Redis and Memcached, which are the kind of primary legacy go-to tools for backend caching, they're decades old. And again, you know, they're used everywhere, but there's actually been kind of a lack of innovation in this space over that last decade or so. You know, if you think about even something like Redis, which is super popular with developers, it's got an awesome API, it's got some awesome data structures, it's easy to get started with. But unfortunately, it was written back in 2009, right? And so if you think about then, there was these web services called SQS and S3 just coming to market, right? So the world looked very different back then. You know, it's single-threaded, not written for cloud scale. And so what we've done is we've totally started over. Inside of Memento, we actually use a different caching engine called Pelican Cache. It was open sourced by Twitter a number of years back, essentially built for cloud scale. And then most importantly, what we've done is we've built a serverless distributed system as kind of the management layer. The biggest issue that you have with the legacy caches today isn't actually performance, right? Redis and Memcache are very fast, but the challenge is that they're just a real pain in the butt to operate. If you think about the evolution of cloud infrastructure kind of moving from, you know, if you just even think about the, you know, the evolution kind of in the AWS ecosystem, you started with having to self-manage these types of frameworks on EC2. Then the jump forward was made with the managed service. So you can use a service like ElastiCache to manage your Redis or your Memcached. Where the world is headed is, you know, I don't even want a cluster. I don't even necessarily want a database. The developer just basically wants a data model API that they can hit. Very similar to something like DynamoDB, where you don't even have to worry about, you know, nodes, instances, or clusters. You know, you basically provision the amount of IOPS that you need. Auto-scaling and adaptive capacity take off from there. And then you basically just get your key value data store from there. And so we wanted to do something very similar for the key value cache, and then also bringing forward advanced data structures as well. So essentially, Memento is a serverless cache where the customer doesn't have to worry about instances, nodes, setup, all of that complexity, things, you know, in the past that were forced onto the customer, like managing cache hit rates, keeping tail latencies low. Our system takes care of that so that customers can focus on what matters, which is scaling their applications and writing new ones. And just last thing I'll note, too, is that, you know, while it's meant to be a serverless cache, it's not only for, you know, small scale Lambda based serverless apps. It is great for those, but it was built with, you know, scale and high availability in mind, capable of managing up to millions of transactions per second in the same way that DynamoDB is serverless and able to handle massive scale. So that's essentially what we're up to currently at Memento.
Now, the founders of Memento, they were ex-DynamoDB engineers or something, right? So there's some commonality there.
Correct. Yeah, both co-founders did work on Dynamo engineering at different times kind of over the last decade. And so many of the kind of learnings that you have from operating large scale infrastructure on DynamoDB has, you know, helped us to kind of construct Memento.
All of the third party tools that I've seen for other parts of the data space, like say dealing with streaming data and aggregations and things like that, none of them are built serverless from the beginning, right? They're all instance based. Why do you think it's so uncommon for companies to start off serverless the way Memento did? Which I think is brilliant, by the way. It's absolutely the way things should be done.
It's a really good question, but it actually has a pretty simple answer, I think, which is, you know, that is one of the benefits that you have as a startup is you get to start over. And so I think the reason why you see, you know, many solutions that don't start serverless is that you have essentially vendors that are having to basically take a legacy serverful product and essentially try to, you know, turn that into serverless. And so they have investment that they're unable to just walk away from. And so unfortunately, you end up with these kind of halfway solutions that aren't kind of built from scratch. So that is the benefit that we have of, you know, starting over. We get to build everything the right way it should be from the ground up, which is exactly what we've done and why we think our solution is so powerful.
All right. Well, we don't want to dive too deep into the tech. That's not really the point here. It's just nice to know kind of what the product is and where it fits in the market. Now, you guys recently announced a seed round of financing, looked like $15 million, led by Bain Capital. What was the environment for raising money like right now, given all the global economic changes and downturns and everything that we're reading about?
I mean, it's certainly a challenging environment, and I think it's certainly different than it was, say, a year ago, certainly from 2 or 3 years back when there was a lot of money and a lot of investment flying around out there. That being said, I think there's a lot more attention, scrutiny, and due diligence put in, but there is money still available out there. Companies just have to be very rigorous throughout their business model, right? And when I say putting in the rigor, particularly, you know, in our instance where we're a cloud-based SaaS offering that's in the infrastructure, we have to be rigorous in the approach that we take to the service and, you know, making sure that we've thought from the get-go about important things like compliance and security, right? Do we have a plan to get to SOC 2 upon launch and not just go and build it and have that as an afterthought? You know, on the GTM side, are you putting rigor into the way you're investing in sales and marketing? Is there a plan there? Are you starting the business out with an eye to, you know, a plan to how you get to profitability someday as opposed to just kind of some of these moonshot businesses a couple of years ago where they basically just had a bright idea and said, we'll figure out the rest later on with a bunch of investments. So as long as you're applying the rigor kind of throughout the business, all the way from the service up to the GTM motion, there's still money available out there for exciting businesses such as ourselves.
Yeah, it's a pretty healthy seed round. I mean, that's twice as big as the Series A round the company I worked at did back in 2015. So there's definitely, like you said, still money kind of sitting on the sidelines waiting for good opportunities. They must have thought that Memento was a solid opportunity. So that's great. Congratulations.
Thank you.
It seems like everyone is pivoting to profits more over growth, or at least moving back towards that side of the spectrum, cutting costs to extend their runway to the next financing round and all of that. Just curious if you can share what kind of guidance you guys got from your VCs when you did this round in terms of how much runway you have or should have to the next round.
We don't really have kind of like the tight timeline there. I mean, obviously we kind of track the burn rate and make sure that we kind of understand what our runway looks like. You know, I think the key thing is that you kind of need to, you can't totally move away from growth. And so the way I would state it is you need to have a responsible plan for growth. You know, I think it's probably unrealistic to think that like a seed round startup's going to be immediately profitable, but I think you need to have a very coherent plan from the get-go about how you get there someday. And so I think that's, you know, what we've enacted to date and what we'll continue to drive moving forward is that, again, conservative investment is probably the wrong word because you still need to be aggressive as you go after these markets. But I would say, you know, responsible investment. So you don't just go out and scale up a sales team overnight. You kind of slowly invest and slowly build it as you actually see impact and revenue coming in the front door from the efforts that you've enacted. So you need to kind of have a responsible plan to churn through the growth and have an eye to how you're going to make the business profitable in the near future, but not necessarily on day one.
Well, that's a nice tee up because that's exactly what we want to talk about next. You're like a professional guest here leading us in. Let's talk about the sales motion and how you approach it, because I think that's the bulk of what we want to talk about today. I mean, in a huge company like Amazon, you're somewhat constrained by how the big machine operates, but now you're at a startup. You can do it however you want. And I know Steve has a bunch of questions here, so I'm going to let him drive.
Yeah, Eric, the first thing I want to start is like, when you guys formed the company, were you thinking about things like product-led motion versus sales-led motion? And how did those conversations go? Where did you end up?
Yeah, so that's a great one. I mean, I think most conversations have to start there, right? Are you going to chase PLG? Are you going to chase sales led? And where we've ended up, and this might sound kind of crazy, and it's definitely a balancing act that you have to be very diligent about how you enact it, but we are actually kind of going with a hybrid motion where we're doing a little bit of both. Every business and every segment that you're going after is very different, right? And so for us, again, remember it's back-end database caching. Quite honestly, part of the reason I think why there's been a lack of innovation and investment in caching is that it is buried deep in the plumbing of infrastructure. And so it doesn't always get, you know, it's not the most exciting topic. It doesn't always get the time and attention. And so how do you then drive a motion for that type of tool, right? And a lot of times the consumer is going to be, you know, a developer who's out trying to scale and manage their database. And, you know, it could be, you know, there's certain forcing functions that are going to make them turn to a cache. And actually, one of our co-founders always has a saying, Daniela, she always says, it's always either too early or too late to add a cache. Either you think that you're, you know, ahead of where you need to be, or you realize that your business has become successful and you're scaling so rapidly, it becomes hard to put it back in. There's a couple of compelling motions that can drive a developer to add the cache, right? So it could be they're doing a point in time, once every 10-year database modernization, right? So they're moving from old school commercial databases like Oracle and SQL Server to something like DynamoDB and NoSQL, or maybe even one of these new SQL solutions out there, and then modernizing the cache as part of that. Or it could just be that it's a hyperscale company. All of a sudden, you know, they're seeing success and massive load, and they need to basically cost optimize and make sure that their databases are staying available and up. And so they're adding cache in that instance. But if you think about that motion, that's pretty organic, right? Like in either of those scenarios, it's kind of like the developer wakes up one day and says, "Up, today I need a cache." And so you want to make sure that you're positioned to intersect that, right? And so that's kind of more of a product-led motion of higher level awareness and credibility so that folks out there are aware of your tool. If they go out and say, "I have a serverless first architecture and I want to look for a serverless cache," are they going to find us and be able to get that inserted in that 24 hours that they're there? You know, that being said, there's also some massive, massive workloads out there. Caches are used in many of the largest scale cloud infrastructure deployments. It'd be crazy for us to not also go find some of those large workloads and bring those over, particularly, you know, that's kind of what we built Momento for, right? We built for the large scale, highly available applications. And that's the beauty of our platform is it is serverless. So it can start with one TPS and scale up to a million. You know, obviously we've built a sales team to do that. And you have to be extremely thoughtful when you kind of go for that approach, because the risk that you run is that you get distracted by trying to do both. And so I think what we're trying to drive is making sure that we're getting organic mind share with developers and that they're aware of us. And then also trying to drive top-down mind share that we can help leadership to achieve their goals of cost optimizing, delivering higher availability, delivering better customer experience. And we've even had some accounts where the two have intersected, where this was one of the proudest moments I've had for my team in the last couple months, is we were engaging a CTO at a hot startup in the Bay Area. We kind of got him to come around to the value proposition that we had to make their DynamoDB tables run a lot better. And he said, okay, I'm going to take this to my team. And he actually came back and said, you know what? You all came up with one of the engineers at the table today before I even brought the topic up. So when you can kind of have both ends of the spectrum, that's success, right? You've gained buy-in from leadership. And then you also have the engineers loving the tool and bringing it to the table.
Yeah. So you mentioned like, starting with product led and, you know, trying to get to that developer that wakes up one morning and saying, okay, I need a cache. And I think one of the ways that starts is by having a place for developers to go and a channel or channels to communicate out what you're doing. I see that you guys have a really nice documentation or the developer hub on the website, which honestly looking at it seems like it's probably going to have almost everything I need to build something successfully without needing your help outside of the docs and the product. What are some other things that you're doing to kind of influence the product-led motion? And then maybe after that or during that, how do you measure whether it's coming from product-led or if it was something else?
The documentation one is a great one. Particularly in today's world, you really live or die by your documentation, so it's got to be good. And you have a very small time window for folks to come, see that it's good, learn what they need to, and decide to give it a try or to move on to something else. Really, the main foundation of our product-led motion is exactly that, which is making sure that the resources are there for the customers. And so we have a big focus on, you know, making sure that the documentation page on the website is crisp, easy to navigate, and has, you know, the depth and the detail that they need. We've also put a huge amount of effort, particularly for an early stage startup, into our blog. So as we find common patterns, right? So here's how you implement a certain application. Here's how gaming customers are implementing it for messaging. Here's how e-commerce customers are applying it.
Reference architecture type stuff.
Exactly. So whether it be reference architectures or just identifying the patterns of where it can be used. If you go and check out our blog, we're putting out like 2 to 3 pieces of what we believe are high quality content per week. The other great thing is there's so much power in just finding advocates for the solution. And so we've put a lot of time into just, you know, there's a really strong community of serverless developers and serverless advocates out there. And so we've put a lot of time into just engaging with those folks and making sure that they understand what Momento is and where we fit into the serverless stack. That's helped immensely. Your question around measurement. So that's always a tough one, right? But there's kind of some easy metrics that you can look at. Momento is extremely easy to get started. You can go to the website, sign up for the CLI. We actually have a 5-minute test. Developers can actually get Momento set up from start to finish in 5 minutes or less. And so we do have a lot of self-serve customers that come in, right? And it's self-serve from the command line with a generous free tier. And so, you know, the easiest metric for us to track is just those customers that basically come in unknown to us through the CLI and self-service versus those that obviously we have a purposeful sales motion and, you know, we're engaging them initially through our sales team. So those are kind of the easiest ones to track.
And you guys have developer advocates as well. I think there's a session actually today that one of the developer advocates is on.
Correct. That's one of the most powerful things that you can do. And another focal area that we've had is what I love to call is basically straight bottom to the funnel marketing activities through our LinkedIn and Twitter communities, our Discord, other channels that we're able to reach folks. We're trying to do 1 to 2 hands-on workshops per month because you can basically take folks from having no idea who Momento was to being hands-on with the service and having built something with it in an hour or less. So it's almost a hybrid, right? Because it's a little bit higher touch. So I wouldn't necessarily call it pure product-led growth. And then some of those also may come into the sales funnel, but it's goodness all around and it kind of drives both motions. And again, that's why in some ways, sometimes the world is a little bit too binary about these things in terms of product-led versus sales. In the reality, in the messy world that we live in, there's a lot of gray area and hence why you kind of need to do a little bit of both in many of these instances.
Well, one of Steve's contentions that we've talked about here before is that he's not sure sales reps necessarily are needed anymore for these SaaS startups. And it's a question that we like to talk to guests about. So do you think that sales reps, whale hunters, whatever you want to call them, the outside guys who go out and try to bring in the big deals, is that something that new startups still need?
Yeah. So I think you absolutely do need them still, but I also get the genesis of the question. I mean, the game is changing, you know, particularly in our domain. Ultimately, the implementer is probably going to be a developer who really doesn't want to be sold to. But that being said, even in those instances, and then particularly when you're talking about large scale infrastructure, there's just going to have to be a procurement process, right? You know, if you're going after multi-million dollar workloads, even six-figure, $100,000 plus deals, everything from convincing the person that ultimately signs the checks to dealing with the procurement department, dealing with legal teams at the customer, there's still a need for this. I think like probably where it's changed the most is like, are those folks really responsible for creating the demand? And that's why we've gone hybrid, is that you need that kind of product-led credibility aspect to actually spark the initial interest. And then you have to have a back-end sales team, you know, that's ready to basically see that spark, see that interest, and then carry it forward. In many ways, it's just about taking that initial engagement and then making it much larger and helping the customer to see the art of the possible.
Is that because the customers won't do six and seven figure deals over a marketplace and they require to have like a custom MSA in place?
Yeah. So that's another good question. The marketplaces, you know, particularly the AWS marketplace, the GCP marketplace, the Azure marketplace really are changing the game because there is procurement processes now in place. And that's actually, that's the power for a startup in those marketplaces, is that we no longer have to go and execute, you know, custom master services agreements at large enterprise customers. You're then, you know, basically when you go through the marketplace, you're covered by the cloud vendor's MSA. And so you can basically jump straight to procurement. So I think it's less about the tactical bit there of like, can they procure for that? Yes, they can. But I think ultimately at the end of the day, they're not only buying the software, like there is still that relationship element, right? And you still want to make sure that you're winning the mind share and educating it. So, you know, I always say that like when you boil GTM down to its most simplest primary components, there's really just two things, right? There's building and shipping amazing products that really help customers with big pain points. And then there's educating them about them, right? And everything in GTM is actually, it's really just about education, right? Whether it's a salesperson on a first call, talking about the high level benefits to get that second or that third meeting, down to the, you know, hands-on solution architect that's doing a in the weeds half day hands-on workshop that's teaching the technical aspects and even the marketing material, right? The documentation is about teaching them, the blog posts and the reference architectures, that's about the teaching as well. So there's always going to be a need to educate customers on your product and your service. And that's where the salespeople, you know, will always continue to fit in, I think.
Eric, have you seen a change in the skill set for a sales rep from when you first started in go-to-market to today?
Yeah, absolutely. And different parts of the kind of like the sales functions are changing to different degrees and at different speeds. So I'd actually say that the area where I've seen it change the most in my time, the 10 years at AWS and then the last year or so here at Momenta, would actually be for the SDRs. If you go back 10 years ago, you know, that standard SDR motion that would have even worked at a small startup our size is you're just, you know, basically dialing for dollars, right? Get contact lists and high propensity customers, and then you basically, you know, just try to get them on the phone and set meetings, right? And challenges like, when's the last time you answered your cell phone from an unknown number?
Yeah, that's right.
People aren't picking up the phone. And even when they do, they don't have the time and the attention, and they don't, you know, they don't like, that's the other thing is you always hear the prototypical like, oh, well, what's your product pitch? Like, I don't want my sellers pitching, right? I want them having engaged and empowered discussions with our customers. I don't want them pitching product. I want them understanding their customer's problem and requirements. And then I want them bringing solutions to those problems to them. The pitching element is gone. And then more importantly, I think the SDRs are, particularly for us, our SDR function is pretty heavily engaged just through social channels, right? So again, you know, as we're generating interest and awareness on our own content on social channels, we have community members that engage with us that warrant follow-up. And then you can also just kind of follow what's happening in, again, some of those serverless communities. And as you're seeing people engaged in some of that open discussion and dialogue, like those become the people that you want to connect with, right? So our SDR function, and we actually have it that it sits in marketing for a couple of different reasons. So one, it's tightly coupled with that awareness and credibility that we're driving, but also it gives, you know, it gives ownership and empowerment to the marketing team to actually go drive revenue, right? I don't want them focused simply on driving first-time users and then they clean their hands of it and they're done. I want them focused on having ownership from the top to the bottom of the funnel. And so by having the SDR sit inside of marketing, it gives them more empowerment to go out and accomplish those lofty goals and ambitions.
Yeah. Yeah, I've seen that similar change with SDRs. Like, they're taking more and more, I guess they're getting more and more of the spotlight a little bit inside the company for all the things that they do, which is that kind of dialing for dollars type role and then educating the customer. So if the Motion is evolving where you have SDRs on the front end, you know, outside of product led. SDRs on the front end dialing for dollars. Then they hand the deal off to a rep, and I imagine the reps are going to get the SEs, SAs involved immediately, right?
Yep.
And then they do the technical validation, eventually hopefully get to a technical win. And then a little bit in parallel, obviously, you get into procurement and legal and then eventually get a deal done. Do you see a world where, like, you could have someone that's dealing, like, their job is specifically to deal with procurement and or their job is specifically to deal with legal, and that's it? And then the reps don't have to hand that off or manage that process?
So I don't think, certainly not in an early stage startup. You know, once you start to hit like a couple hundred million in revenue, like, yeah, I think so. I mean, if you look at even some of the large cloud vendors out there, I think you have those functions. But you have to be at a pretty significant scale for that.
How come? Why can't you just have like a someone on the deal desk basically at the very beginning of the company, and their job is to get customers through procurement, through legal, and then sign on the dotted line?
Yeah, to me, it's just not a good use of our resources right now, like particularly given that we're building this thing from the ground up right now. And then also, I mean, this also comes back to that point around the marketplaces, right? Where like, because those have eliminated a lot of that friction,
yeah,
I'm better off investing that resource into these folks that can go educate the customers and evangelize the service than I am into like smoothing the procurement process, because AWS and GCP and Azure have already taken meaningful steps to do that for me.
Yeah, that's totally fair.
Early days at AWS, when I first started there back in like 2012, 2013, you know, the marketplace was just getting up and going, and you didn't see it like very well ingrained in the field there. But now it's a massive thing, right? Both for, you know, the AWS field kind of driving those motions, and then particularly if you're a SaaS cloud-based vendor, it's a huge, huge channel now. So I think it's only going to continue you're only going to continue to see innovation, and it's going to evolve.
Yep. I agree. So Eric, when you're thinking about like the incentive structures for the go-to-market team, are you innovating there at all? Or are you just using what you've, like, not to say that it's wrong, but like, you know, taking what you've learned previously and just applying it to the new company, maybe with a tweak or two? Or are you actually meaningfully changing any of the incentives that the go-to-market team uses?
We've done some minor tweaking. I would say that we've taken what's been proven and tried to tweak it, as opposed to like totally blowing up the old model and starting over.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, our account managers have a pretty familiar looking incentive structure. The most important thing I think with incentives and compensation is you always have to think about what are the priorities for where the company is at right now, and do the incentives align to that, right? So our variable compensation for our salespeople today looks probably a lot different than it will say 3 years from now when we're a much larger company. So for example, right now there's obviously a commission and usage based element to it, but we also prioritize variable compensation just for getting, you know, public reference wins,
adding logos.
Exactly. And then getting, you know, individual wins as well, right? Because for us right now, every single customer, every single logo is important. And so you want to make sure that you're, you know, because if you don't do that, and you incentivize purely as a percentage of a commission-based, you know, sales that are closed, then you're going to incentivize them to only go chase the huge deals, right? And they're going to ignore that small or medium customer who could actually get in the door very quickly, and then also get to be a really powerful advocate and proponent for the company and talk about us as a reference. So I think that's the most important thing with the compensation, is you want to just make sure that it aligns to where the company is at today and what the priorities really are.
I want to drill down into that a little bit. So for SAs versus sales reps, moving to AWS was a big change for me. It was the first place where I worked where SAs don't have a compensation plan, or there's no commission structure. I mean, are you guys doing something similar, given that you have a lot of AWS background at your company?
Yeah, we are doing something very similar. So, and I think it comes down to the, you know, the philosophical approach is that I really want our solution architects to be really trusted advisors to the customer. And so when something's not a right fit, including Momento, I want them to be honest and forthright with that. And so I think that's really the power of why you don't put the solution architects or the sales engineers on variable compensation, is because you want them to develop that really deep trusted advisory role to the customer.
I couldn't agree more. I've argued with Steve on this several times in the past, and maybe I've changed his mind, I don't know, but I absolutely agree with you that that's the right way to do it. Based on just what I've seen here in the last 4 years, it totally changes everything.
I think that's interesting because, like, and maybe I'm an anomaly here, but I've never thought about my incentive structure influencing my psychology to lie to a customer to get them to buy my product, because my reputation is more important than any commission I would ever make. And so my approach to sales engineering has always been, I have a reputation to uphold, and like, I'm not going to hawk a product I don't believe in, which I don't think many people would.
Right. So if it's not affecting your behavior,
yeah,
then, you know, why have the complication of managing a variable structure?
I agree with you. Like, that's the part I agree with, is like, it's not changing my perspective and it's not changing my actions in the field. I still want to win because I know that we need deals to make a great company and for everyone to benefit. That's what drives me, not the, you know, that big commission check potentially.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So we have these commission plans for sales reps and they have earnings potential that's massive, right? Like, I've seen reps make over $1 million on one deal, even $3 million on a deal. And to me, I cannot figure out what they're doing that's worth that much money versus the SE versus the SDR versus the lawyer versus everybody else that's involved in the deal. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So it's a fair question. I mean, I guess it also comes down to, like, do you have a cap on the compensation, right? So that you don't have people like riding multi-million dollar payouts on the efforts of the collective team. And then I think, you know, if you're not giving the solution architects and the sales engineers variable compensation, you just have to be very thoughtful about how that's structured, because certainly I think you want, you know, everybody getting their share of the work that's put in.
Do you think you could have a model where sales reps and SEs don't make commission? They just make a salary, and maybe there's like incentives, like you said, for new logos and things like that. But ultimately they're still just making a salary like everybody else, and they get equity like everybody else, and it changes kind of how they think, maybe.
Yeah, I think there is a model like that. I'm trying to think. I think there's a startup called Mini.io who's kind of in the storage market, and they have raised a bunch of rounds and have actually been quite public, I think, in some of those blog posts about how they don't actually have a single quoted salesperson on staff. So I think you're already starting to see a couple businesses make it work. And I think in principle, you can get to a place where that can work. Because to your point, I think, you know, whether it be the SA or the salesperson, like, their own personal brand and credibility is really what kind of motivates and drives people at the end of the day. So I think you can get there. It's just that, do you drive radical transformation of this pretty established kind of IT sales motion that's been here for 40 to 50 years, or is it more of a gradual kind of evolution there? And I think it's probably the latter.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think it is more gradual. I find it interesting. Like, because I've been asking myself this question a lot, it's like, when I have this conversation with people, one of the things they always say is, what about, and then they name a rep that's amazing. And I do the same thing. It's like, what about this person? How would I slot them into this new model of selling, enterprise selling? And I broke it down one day with someone where it was like, well, what is that person doing that makes them the exception, not the rule? Because I think most people probably listening to this know that most sales reps don't make that $1 million commission. It's very rare. And it's like, well, what did that person do to get that commission, to earn that commission? And like, one of them is their network, right? They're just very well connected. They've been in the industry for a long time and they're trusted. Obviously their name, their reputation matters to them, and it matters to, you know, it influences how they operate. The other one is they're just really damn hardworking. Like, they're always on the phone. They're always doing something. They're always communicating, always driving the next 2 to 3 steps in any sales cycle. And then they know who to bring in at the right time usually. And that's another skill that's like, okay, they brought in this SE, then they brought in this engineer, then they brought in one of the founders, then they brought in the CTO. And it's like, after the 6 months, you look at that, it's like, wow, we all won this together. But then the rep is the one taking home the $1 million commission check. And it feels like that money could be reinvested in the business in other ways. So it's not like I'm advocating to get rid of sales reps. Part of what I'm saying is, like, there's got to be a way where we can get to a point where the effort matches the reward. And I feel deep in my gut that it doesn't right now. And I know I'm arguing against 40, 50 years of, you know, what we would call maybe modern enterprise IT selling, but it just feels like the buyer has evolved so much that we need to adjust on the seller side a little bit, like you're saying, and maybe Mini.io is onto something. I don't know.
Do you think Tom Brady's overpaid compared to his left tackle?
That's a good question. I think it's different. I think Tom Brady is kind of like the mini coach on the field, right? He's orchestrating the entire thing. And if you think a sales rep is orchestrating the entire thing, I would say, yes, the good ones are.
Well, that's what you were just saying, right? They're bringing in the right people at the right time.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's not to say that an SE couldn't bring in the right person at the right time, you know? So kind of like people have said, developers are the new kingmakers. I'm making an argument, good or bad, that SEs are becoming the new kingmakers in the go-to-market motion because of the buyers changing, the technology changing, and it's basically developers talking to developers. And then everybody else, in quotes, goes and makes the deal happen, right? And then eventually we get a deal. And I know SEs typically don't want to be involved in that procurement cycle, the legal cycle. They definitely don't want to be dialing for dollars. But I think you can replace all those with different roles that augment the team, not have like one potential person quarterbacking the entire thing. And maybe that's a flaw in my thinking, honestly. Because if you don't have that person, what are you going to do?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that's the thing, is that you're, like, to Chad's point, I think ultimately at the end of the day, you're compensating the salesperson and providing an incentive to drive that orchestration.
Yeah.
And to drive the diligence and the attention and making sure that the mundane, you know, the power of sales is that it's the smallest, most mundane things, like, does the follow-up go out within 5 minutes of the meeting happening? Are there detailed notes? Who's the next owner? Who's doing it? Is you're incentivizing them to drive those mundane details. And then essentially, if they're getting those right, then they're going to see the compensation to go with it. Those types of mundane details are not what I want my sales engineer spending their valuable time doing.
Yeah.
You know, I want them zeroed in, working hands-on with customers, helping them to understand, you know, understand the biggest challenges that they're facing, and then, you know, providing solutions to those problems and getting the service implemented. So it would actually be a poor use of time for them to have to drive that follow-up. And so hence why I think, you know, it still makes sense for that division of labor between those account teams, and that you really want the salesperson, even in a highly technical environment, to, in some ways, they're almost like a really important project manager, right? What's the next step? Who's engaging? Who's driving it? That's what they need to be doing. And that's what we incentivize them on with their variable compensation.
Yeah, yeah.
I get your point. I mean, it's like everything within reason, right? So sometimes,
yeah, reason. Yeah.
You know, these compensation plans where you have reps pulling down like multi-million-dollar payouts, like, yeah, there might be a more efficient way to redeploy that capital for the business and the team.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what I'm wondering. Because like you said something that I've heard a lot of people say, which is SEs and valuable in the same sentence. And I agree with you. Like, you know, it's a very valuable skill set. It's still pretty uncommon. But it's like no one ever says the reps are expensive. And I don't get that. It's like SEs don't make that kind of money. They don't even have that potential to make that kind of money. So I don't understand why everyone says they're super expensive resources. And it could just be that I've never been a go-to-market leader like that and managed the P&L. I've always just been an SE and an SE leader, which is totally fair. So I haven't seen like how the numbers actually shake out in the end. But it just makes me wonder and ask the question is all.
One that I spend a lot of time thinking about is what's the right ratio? For example, at AWS, for the majority of time when I was there, like the average account team was 1-to-1, right? Yeah. You had one salesperson matched with one solution architect.
Yeah.
It depends again on what is your service? What is your product? How technical is it? How well does it work? How easy is it to use? You know, in a perfect world, you hopefully don't need too much sales engineer engagement, because that might mean that the service isn't working that elegantly. But, you know, at the same time, even with elegant software, you know, we're really proud of how easy and simple it is to use Momentum and get started. But at the same time, you still need to educate the customer, whether it be like the problems and the challenges that they can solve with the solution down to the implementation, there's still a need for that. But you always need to think about what's the right ratio, right? Like, can one high performing salesperson that's super dialed in and on top of their details and their follow up and engaging their customers keep two or three of these folks busy, right? And some, that's the right answer.
I agree with you on that, actually. I think one of the thought experiments I've done is take one of these amazing reps I've worked with before, give them five SEs, give them 5x the account coverage, and give them 5x the account list territory. And if they're that good, I think they could actually go and start up all these little brush fires on all these different places, hand them off to the SE to go and get that technical win, because we all know it takes weeks, maybe months to get. And then just, you know, basically round robin style, almost token ring, like check back in. Okay, how's that deal going? How's that deal going? How's that deal going? It almost seems like that would be a more efficient way to do it. But I don't know if contextually a sales rep could do that, right? Like, I don't know how you would map to 5 to 10 SEs and all those different accounts. It might be too much to keep track of in your mind. I don't know.
And the sales reps like to be out on the road a lot of the time too, and they can only visit so many customers if they're driving around or flying around.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's fair.
How are you guys handling the comp structure for the sales team, given that the product itself is serverless? I mean, logos I get, incentivizing new logos I get, but if the product itself doesn't really lend itself towards, well, I need $1 million right now, right? I'm going to use a little bit, like you said, one TPS and then ramp my way up. How do you think about that, or how are you guys doing that?
The variable compensation is based on the usage. But the reality is that we look at it over like a 6 to 9 month period of when the customer onboards, and you have, you know, and we actually already have multiple customers that have done six figure deals with us, just because even through the pay as you go, you know, usage, they're going to be at a large scale when they onboard. The larger they are, you know, there's some flexibility to do committed deals as well. Like, just because a serverless service is serverless doesn't mean that you can't do
pre-commit. Yeah.
Pre-commit. Exactly. So those two elements feed into it, right? Even when they come in on demand pay as they go, they can be at such a large scale that it can be, you know, there's a big financial incentive to get those customers on. And then there's always the negotiation that can happen for the largest of large customers that are doing some sort of pre-commitment.
Are you guys built on top of Metronome or anything like that for handling all of the metering and billing of your service? I'm just curious because we've had some Elastic people, friends that have gone to Metronome, which I think is a brilliant service built for servicing other SaaS companies, you know?
Yeah, we are not built with Metronome today.
Okay.
Well, we're handling all of our billing and metering ourselves.
You built it all internally. When I saw that launch and started seeing people go there, I thought that was just such a great idea, because all these startups that are starting up, they want to focus on their core expertise, which is caching or whatever it is, right? Analytics, and not have to have people write all the code for doing metering and billing. Anyway,
it makes sense. And, you know, we've used not quite the same, but like, for example, to get onto the AWS marketplace, we worked with Tackle.io.
Oh, yeah, Tackle.
Because, again, they're experts at doing that stuff very quickly. And it made sense for us to work with them and not burn the time of our own people. So I think wherever you can find, you know, some of those kind of leverage points at a reasonable cost, you want to take advantage. But again, you always have to balance responsibly what's this going to cost me versus what it's going to cost me to do it myself. And is there like a market upshot in terms of the benefit you get by getting to market faster and the pure cost savings? So I think in many instances, those types of solutions do make sense.
I'm sure you guys are using HubSpot and ZoomInfo and those types of sales. Any other cool new sales and marketing tools you've discovered now that you've gone into the startup area and looked at this space? What's in your tool belt?
Exactly. There seems to be new ones every single day. So our stack today is basically HubSpot, SalesLoft, ZoomInfo, and Salesforce.com. I really love HubSpot. We found so much power and just exciting stuff that you can do with that platform. It's fantastic. There seem to be new ones coming out every day. Interesting ones that I've kind of looked at but haven't adopted would be Gong and a few others. That'll be an interesting space as well. I mean, I think there's been a flurry of investment in that space over the last like 5 or so years. And so now that we're kind of hitting some tougher times, I would imagine there's going to be some consolidation in that space, but that's just a guess.
One thing we've talked about before was the HashiCorp State of Cloud Strategy survey that they released earlier this year was talking about how many companies are pursuing a multi-cloud strategy. And now that you're not at a cloud vendor, maybe you can speak more freely about your thoughts about multi-cloud and whether you think that's a good idea for companies to pursue it.
I see it both ways, right? So the downside of like why I think sometimes it's not a great idea to pursue is that you do, there's definitely truth to that bit of like that you're kind of getting the lowest common denominator of all the clouds, right? Because all of them are investing and trying to innovate in some of their own pieces of cutting edge infrastructure. And so by trying to spread it out and be able to just, you know, lift and shift stuff between the raw compute instances from one cloud to the other, you really do risk missing out on some of those most innovative, most powerful tools that each of the vendors is providing. So really, you know, making your choice and going really deep in that ecosystem, I think does have huge benefit. And I think that's, honestly, I think that's probably the, you know, the strategy that you know, most large organizations and customers really should pursue. But I also get the other element of it, which is, you know, basically negotiation power, right? Which is, you know, if I can move between, then I have an ability to negotiate a little bit better, and as well as, you know, it's a risk mitigation factor, right? A lot of times I actually think that multi-cloud is driven way less from the technical bits, because if it was driven by the, you know, the technical benefits, what I just talked about would be respected, and they'd say, you know, there's more value and quality by going deeper into one ecosystem and staying there. But a lot of times I think it's driven by, you know, risk mitigation at either the board of directors level or, you know, somewhere further down in the management chain, where they just want to know that all of the eggs aren't in a single basket, and feeling like they're at the, you know, the mercy of a single vendor. So I think that's the stuff that drives the desire to be able to check that box. And many times I think it's more of an escape hatch than it is an actual like plan.
It might also be accidental, because you might have been single cloud and then you acquired a company. They're using a different cloud vendor. You know, bam, you're multi-cloud.
Yeah.
Or you merge with somebody and, you know, they were Azure and you're AWS. Bam, you're multi-cloud.
Exactly.
So it just kind of happens whether you wanted to or not.
Yeah.
And a lot of my conversations with customers, it seems like Shadow IT is responsible for their multi-cloud strategy. It's like, we hired a developer, they had a preference for Azure. Next thing you know, we're on Amazon and Azure. And it's like, it got away from them, and now they're trying to react to it. So,
is your service available on multiple cloud vendors or?
Correct. So today we're offered in AWS and GCP.
Okay. So you actually build on top of their stuff because you need to be close to where the app is running anyway.
Correct.
For the low latency stuff to matter.
Yep. The AWS offering is built in AWS. The GCP offering is built in GCP. I will note on that, though. I mean, we do have some larger enterprises and organizations that are working with us because we're third party, right? So they're doing database modernizations and they've got a third party NewSQL database with Momento as the caching layer, because they can run it in AWS or GCP, so that, you know, they see that as an upshot to their stated corporate multi-cloud strategy.
So they might be using MongoDB multi-cloud or Cockroach multi-cloud or something like that, and they want a multi-cloud or neutral third party caching on top of that.
Correct. So
yeah, it totally makes sense.
I wouldn't say that I've seen a lot of that, but there is some of it out there for sure.
I think we'll see more and more of that probably over time.
Yeah, I gotta believe that.
Well, we got 5 minutes left here, so let's talk about the future a little bit. Like, what kinds of things can you share that you're thinking about on your roadmap, or just that you're looking at?
It's always interesting life at an early stage startup, because you know, 6 months is an eternity in startup land. So it's really hard for me to even give you speculation about more than a year that I can see in front of me. But, you know, I think the things that we're razor focused on right now, shipping more of the advanced data structures. So we're making fast progress. We've given our customers already access to a lot of the most used APIs that they have in Redis, you know, as callable in Momento. So I think we'll be continuing to ship as many advanced data structures that are actually used by customers. That's the other thing, is like, with a lot of these open source standards, you know, you have like hundreds or thousands of APIs, but it turns out the customers actually really only use like 10 to 20. And so you have to be really good at prioritizing, finding out which are those ones that they actually use. And then the two other probably pretty obvious ones, but really important ones, are basically expansion in the cloud. So basically more regions of AWS and GCP, and then also adding Azure in the near term as well.
Awesome. Awesome. And I know that there's a lot of good tech people out there looking for jobs right now. So are you guys hiring? And if so, for what roles?
Yeah, we are. We have a pretty staffed up team. So I wouldn't say that we're in a massive expansion cycle. But that being said, we are growing. We're looking for engineers, product managers, solution architects, and any good salespeople that are out there as well. We are certainly open to taking a look. And we always want to chat with great talent and new folks.
Eric, are you mostly US based?
We are, but our team is actually highly distributed throughout the US. So we started in the pandemic. So
yeah,
we have folks East Coast, West Coast, and in the middle as well.
Remote first company?
Remote first company, yes. But we actually do have a small office presence in Kirkland, Washington now.
Oh, nice. Okay.
Yeah. Well, all the XAWS people, I'm sure, are centered in that area. Well, Eric, thanks for joining us today. Steve and I are tech nerds, but we're also sales nerds, and we love to talk about this go-to-market sales strategy type stuff. So that was a really nice conversation. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you guys. This was a great conversation. I enjoyed it as well. A lot of fun.
Momento's going great places. I'm sure of it. It's going to be very successful. And I wish I could have gotten in on the seed round, you know, wet my beak a little bit.
We certainly think so.
All right, everybody. If you like this episode, please share it out on LinkedIn, share it out on Twitter. We're growing our listener base one listener at a time, and everybody can help by just telling one person about it. If you can, we appreciate it very much, and thanks for listening.
Thanks, everybody.